let's press on with this. And any questions? I know we've gone pretty far afield at lunch and the rest. and we've had a good time, so that makes me happy. And anyway, you get a book. So, yeah.
The people who are motivated, that's very easy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Usually people who are motivated, they have intrinsic motivators and they have them everywhere in their life, right?
Yes.
There are people who somehow need external stimulation in order to get to the motivation.
Yes.
And I assume everybody has internal motivators, right? It just, there are people, certain people who are always, I know my daughter, for example, she's always motivated with external stuff.
Yes.
And going down, deep down to her internal stuff may be somehow more difficult to.
Yes.
So that's what I'm interested in, how to evoke that with people who are not.
And that's what we're going to be talking about this afternoon, okay? And what's that?
Just as when he came back.
but that's the crux of the matter. How do you begin to draw people into positive motivations? And we already looked at two. One was asking, very simply asking, all right, what do you need to happen in your life for this not to be a problem? And very often you will find that people know. Other people don't know, and that's, of course, the problem that we're talking about. Well, if you take a look at section six, we have that. Second thing, we have asking, all right? What do you need to have to do in order for this not to be a problem? All right? We can use meta models to challenge it. I these aren't paginated, but if you look at what must be page 7 or 8, I guess, it's VI. VI, okay? You know, VI. I don't speak Latin. What's that?
It's for the motivated.
Yes, yes. Making changes, motivated changers. Use well-formed outcomes. Sometimes the problem is not that people don't know, but it isn't structured appropriately. They have a vague idea. And so it might be very useful to walk them through that. Go through two or several of them. All right, Dee Kinder, who's also making presentations here, when she takes people through smart outcomes, one of the things that she does is she has them pick up two or three outcomes, all right, and say, well, if you can't have the first one, what's the second one? If you can't have the second one, what's the third one? All right, there's a hierarchy already. If we go through those and begin to apply those criteria to them, very often, one or another of them will come up and surprise somebody and say, wow, I really like that. If you think about choosing a resource state the way we did before, one of the things that you may have noticed is you start with one and you go to another, and that's pretty good, and then suddenly you begin to get a taste of the state, and another one pops up, and that's the one. Well, that same thing happens with people. It isn't so much that they don't have something that can motivate them, but they aren't aware of it. It isn't structured appropriately. They don't understand that they could have it or how to get there from here. And that's a crucial piece. Something just went through my head that I wanted to talk about, but it went out again, and I hope it comes back. That's right. Bam! There it is. Okay. Let's see.
That's a truck.
Look out for the truck! Oh, no. Okay. Hi. So well-formed outcomes, all right? What do you want? How do you get somebody to that? And if we think back to resource states, one of the utilities, and we'll get into this a little bit more as the afternoon goes on, is if you access that resource state, that can become the center of your coming to know what you want, all right? Carl Jung developed the theory of archetypes. Archetypes are centers of behavioral energies that drive behavior. He linked them to what was then called instincts, but they're really about deep drives within the human psyche. And James Hillman, who was the head of the Jung Institute down in Texas for years and years, came up with his view of archetypal psychology, and he said this, that any emotion that's deep enough and profound enough is intrinsically archetypal in its power. What's that mean? That means that you give somebody something like this anchor, something that allows them to get in touch with what it means to be them and to feel good about that. And realistically speaking, when you get to an oceanic feeling, what Connie Ray Andrews would call a core state, you're talking about who I am. And suppose you move that into the future and say, if you could feel this way for more of your life, more of the time, what would you be doing? Archetypes are always tied to behaviors. All right? There's no emotion. Remember that archetypes are centers of affect, centers of emotion. There is no emotion that does not imply movement. Movement towards, movement away, movement in anger, movement in fear, movement in love or lust, movement into quiescence, all right, movement in some direction. And so when we consider the fact that we can give somebody a powerful sense of what it feels like to be you and to feel good about that, and we can connect that back to a historical set of states that they've always had with them, even if they've ignored them for many years, we can begin to get at a set of directions that help them plan, that can help them to plan who they can be if they begin to move in consonance with that feeling. And that's the heart of what we did. The heart was first give someone the experience of what it means to be healed, whole, a human being that is happy with who I am and who I can be. But then what does that mean for the future? Where does that take me? One thing I usually do with my students several times with different classes during the years is I'll have them do a timeline exercise. I have them build a timeline and see themselves way ahead in the timeline, 90 years old, healthy, in their right mind, crucial criteria here, healthy, in your right mind, having accomplished a lot.
Do you have them walk it?
Yeah, I have them sit in the chair and imagine floating out there. After they've built the timeline, float out there, see that person's face, step into that body, all right, and just feel what they have to say. Talk to them and get a sense of the kinds of things that you're proud of, that you're glad of. What were the important decisions? All right. When I have people go into the future, sometimes I'll ask them, think back to the time before you did this, way back in 2010, you know, back there in October of 2010, when you're back there in California. If you could go back there from this perspective, what were three things in your history that were really, really meaningful to you? What were three things that set the tone of your life in a way that you can appreciate now that you're 70 or 90 or whatever it is, all right, that if you had paid a little more attention, it would have made that transition a little easier. Okay?
Meaningful.
Meaningful, that's the word. Oh, if you don't catch me quick, it just goes away. But that's why tape recorders are good. Meaningful, all right? And so I go back in time. And what do I find? I find, one, my father was mayor of Red Bank, little town in New Jersey. And one day, the metropolitan of the Russian Orthodox Church, the Russian Pope, came to Red Bank to visit our little, you know, 4x5 Russian Orthodox Church. And my brother and I had to get dressed up on the Saturday. The police cars came in and flags and everything else. And these guys in long cassocks and big hats and long beards came in. And they sat down and we had to stay in a side room while they sat and talked with my father. And it was time for the audience. And, you know, being good American, you can say, hi, how you doing? I'm going to shake the guy's hand. These two big guys in cassocks came and shoved us down on our knees, shoved this guy's fist in our face. We had to kiss his ring, laid hands on the set, something in Russian, and ushered us out of the room. But somehow me living someplace way in the future thinks that was important. Maybe there really was a blessing. Maybe I got zapped by the metropolitan of the Russian Orthodox Church. Another time I was about 8, and we lived on the Navasink River. I'm looking along the river, and I suddenly realized that I can walk from my house all the way to Marine Park, a distance about a mile along the riverbank. I don't have to cross a street. I know how to get there and get back. I can do it without getting lost. I know my way around the world. Wow! Okay, so I got zapped. I know my way around the world. And the third one was botany. Botany changed my life. When I went to school, I intended to be a psych major. And psychology was so dismally boring, intro psych was so bad, that I regularly fell asleep and did automatic writing in my notebook that said, "Help me, get me out of here. I still have it. I could show it to you." So I changed my major to biology, and I took, you know, intro biology and zoology, and the next thing along was botany. And I said, you got to take botany. It's probably going to be terrible boring. Well, the teacher was good. It was interesting. Didn't have to study much. I could listen and just pick it up auditorily. And that was good, but I walked out into the woods the next summer, and the world had changed. Everything had a name. Ecology had a meaning. There were relationships, and the woods spoke to me. And I wasn't tripping at the time. The reality is that botany had just changed the way I understood the world. Something didn't affect me like that until I took systems theory as a PhD student. And the reality is those three things, when I begin to consider them, they were earth-shaking events in my life. One was just crazy mystery. One was about seeing what I could do. And the other one was the nature of meaning. And for some reason, me in the future says those are very valuable. And there are a few others since then that I've added to it. So one of the things that you might consider doing is asking somebody or taking somebody on a trip into their future. Well, suppose that you could step into your body and know that you've been successful, you've done well, all right, and you're 90 years old and you're healthy. Do that, please. Some people think 90 and they think, falling apart. But it's possibly 90, healthy, sane, and feeling good about who you are and what you've done. My wife's grandmother lived amazingly well. Every Friday at 93, she was getting in her car, driving very slowly to the beauty parlor to have her hair done, you know, taking care of herself, living alone, and functioning wonderfully well with never a complaint except sometimes a little arthritis in her hands. Thank God. All right? She lived until she was 99 and broke her hip, and that ended it. But the reality is that people do live that way. If you could step into that and begin to appreciate what your life was and give yourself a message. Now, if you see that, you know those three things from that perspective, what can you tell yourself back there in 2010 that you needed to hear them? And then ask your client to wait until they can actually hear that. Not imagine what it might be, but to hear it from themselves in the future. One of the things that can do is that can awaken a pathway towards the future that gives somebody hope where they can begin to make some plans. It begins to lay an effective base that will allow them to choose some directions that are suggested by the feeling they get from their imagined self. Milton Erickson's pseudo-orientations in time is absolutely genius. All right. One of the things he would do is he would have people in a trance state, and he'd have them imagine six crystal balls. And the six crystal balls, each of them had a different resolution to their problem sometime in the future. And he asked their unconscious mind to watch those crystal balls and to consider which of them was going to provide the answer that they needed without consulting the conscious mind. And he'd leave them in there for 20 minutes, half an hour, 45 minutes, just meditating on that. And they would come out and their life would change. What? Didn't tell them anything, none of his famous stories. Just consider these possibilities. And they would come back, and their life would be subtly reoriented on an affective level, on the level of emotion, where they began to make different kinds of choices. And one of the striking things that I've come to understand about pseudo-orientations in time is when you move into the future with an affective direction, it cannot help but stimulate your imagination so that you can begin to structure real steps in that direction. The more you can specify them, the better off you are. We'll come back to that a little bit more experientially. Use end-state energy. I already talked to you about end-state energy from John Overdurf, but this is really, really powerful. All right? And he states it, if only I had X, this wouldn't be a problem. Sounds like asking people again, doesn't it? But let's say, suppose you had that. Step into that future. Feel it now. Imagine you had, oh, I can't. Well, just, if you could, what would it feel like? Use your meta model and draw someone into that feeling and let them feel what it's like at the end of it. Not the frustration of how do I get there from here? Not the frustration of this is too much for me to do? But how does it feel to have it now? Now, the important thing to consider is that that doesn't provide the competencies necessary to get there. But it can provide a kick. It can provide enough of an emotional direction that somebody can begin to consider going there. And then he adds the crucial part, and that crucial part is what's the smallest next step? And he's careful to say it doesn't matter if it's realistic, if it's related or not, as long as it's something that they can do, they can feel good about right now, and they can relate it to that positive affect. They've made some progress, and they've gotten the whole system moving, and that's the crucial piece. Okay? Now, he also says, what happens if they get the feeling and nothing they've planned relates to that? Nothing they've ever imagined is even closely related to that feeling. Or they say, I don't want that. Well, how do you want to feel then? Very simply, change it, like changing the way somebody holds their head. All right? How do you want to feel 5 years from now? If you could be successful 5 years from now, how would you feel? And this is the very Jungian part of me, all right? If we root it in feelings, we have the root of behaviors. We have the root of perceptions. Jung's definition of an archetype is that it is the root elements, the preconditions for perception and action. They are the unspeakable tendencies that we have that form our capacities to see, hear, feel, smell, taste, and to respond to those things. They are the inchoate nuclei of behavior. And when we evoke them as powerful feelings, we are implicitly invoking behavior. And so John suggests, well, how do you want to feel? And how does that relate back? That relates back to Milton Erickson, okay, who has people experiencing these transcendent states. What happens? Jung suggests that when we let go of ego and descend into the unconscious in a positive way, our egos are implicitly restructured. They are restructured by our unconscious tendencies, by our strengths, by our desires, by that part of the personal unconscious that is not repressed negativity, but is all of the power of the unconscious that we don't know yet about our own capacities. And as that's the power of meditation. That's the power partly of prayer. That's the power of trance. Why do you think Erickson would put somebody in trance and go do his bills for 45 minutes or an hour? Well, they're just out there floating. Because the unconscious knows. It knows what to do. All right? Michael Hall notwithstanding. I like Mike. He's a good guy. And he likes to put things into conscious control. And I think that has a lot to be said for it. All right? But as much as that has to be said for it, we also need to recognize that there are places where we can make use of the unconscious consciously. And part of that is allowing somebody to feel good. Allowing somebody to enter into a trance state where they are safe, they are whole, and they connect in that trance state back to everything that makes them human, back to everything that is free from the problems they've been exhibiting, and can allow some of the resources that have always been there to resurface. But we need to make that explicit. It's not always enough just to make somebody feel good. A lot of people feel good, and they walk out and they still do bad things. Other people feel that and they run with it. Say, wow, if I can feel this way, I can do anything. Turns on that left orbital frontal cortex and they begin to do stuff. Other people need more coaching. And the key piece very often is if you feel this way, or if you were to feel this way more often, what would you do? Now, one of the things I point to is the miracle method. The miracle method makes use of these mechanisms very explicitly. It comes out of the work of Insoo Kim Berg.